into the cage where the monster was kept. There, locked in the arms of a giant baboon, rigid and smiling, lay Mrs. Ravone. I climbed the clock tower in the first morning sun, and 'twas midday at least ere my journey was done. But the clock never sounded the last stroke of noon, for there from the clapper swung Mrs. Ravone. I hauled in the line. At the half-eaten horror that hung from the hook, I had dragged from the depths of the limpid lagoon the luminous body of Mrs. Ravone. I fled in the storm through lightning and thunder, and there, as a flash split the darkness asunder, chewing a rat's tail and mumbling a rune, mad in the moat, squatted Mrs. Ravone. I stood by the water so green and so thick, and I stirred at the scum with my old withered stick, when there rose through the ooze like a monstrous balloon the bloated cadaver of Mrs. Ravone. Facing the fens, I looked back from the shore, where all had been empty a moment before, and there, by the light of the Lincolnshire moon, immense on the marshes, stood Mrs. Ravone. Oh, yes, I know I'm back. Oh, I know I'm back here. It's unmistakable. It's Monday, and the quiet miasma of life comes drifting down out of the outermost reaches of the firmament. It's hot. Steamy. And believe me, when we enter this hothouse atmosphere, this miasmic ooze, there is an unmistakable sense of a peculiar kind of life. And you've got to admit it, even though you say, oh, it's hot, oh, nevertheless, there is something primal about it. You know what I mean by that? Something peculiar. It's like a cake of yeast steaming. Now, the yeast may complain, you know. Oh, it's hot, away. But it's sure bubbling. It's sure foaming. And in an odd kind of way, this is almost the sensation you feel in Africa, you know. There's a heat that hangs over everything. And no one's really, after a while, you know, after 18 million years in Africa, nobody even talks about the heat. Are you aware of that? Nobody mentions the heat in Africa except somebody who's just showed up. And there is a sense there of being in the middle of a kind of dank swamp that is so much alive, so teeming with life, that you don't know where to look for it all. You know, everything moves, the horizon, everything. You feel that in New York, you know, when it's hot. It's baking. You know, speaking of the primal ooze, somebody sent me a clipping of some guy out in Jersey. A big thing happened in Jersey. I don't have the clipping with me, but I'll have to describe. The pictures were unbelievable. It seems that somebody was sent out to the city dump, or some dump. Anyway, it was a dump, you know, big, thick dump. And he was sent out there to do some work with a new bulldozer, an $18,000 bulldozer. And he drives up on this dump, and he starts to do whatever it is. And suddenly he finds the bulldozer sinking into this glop. Tin cans, tires, old corsets, and dead birds, and, you know, everything. You know what's out in this, you know what's out in the dumps. And he's sinking into it. And he's sinking faster and faster. And suddenly he leaps off of the thing off of his bulldozer, a new $18,000 bulldozer, and with a sudden... the dump swallowed up his new monster earth mover. Gulped it down just like a catfish gulping down a dough ball. Gone, not a trace. Not a trace. It wasn't sticking up or sunk to the hubs. It was gone. And there was a picture of the dump, and you couldn't see anything but tin cans and glop and old shoes and tires. And stench rising out of it. The bulldozer was gone. The guy's frantic. He rushes back to the officials. He says, "My bulldozer's gone. $18,000 gone. It's gone. Now what are you going to do?" And they didn't know what to do, so they went and they poked sticks down. And they couldn't find it. They could not find the bulldozer in the glop. And they're poking around, and, you know, every guy's afraid he's going to sink in the stuff. You know, they're poking and fooling around and stick. They could find no trace of the bulldozer. And then, the most sinister thing of all, somebody suggested they get a deep-sea diver. That's the truth. And they went, they got this deep-sea diver, you know, the real kind. I don't mean the kind of guys with the little skin suits, you know, with the little things on the back, with the paddlers, you know, the flippers on the back. This is a real diver, you know, the kind of what they call a blue-water diver. You know what is it, a blue-water diver? The kind of guy they lower 8 miles into the sea, you know, with a big bulb on his head, the big metal helmet with a big glass thing with the little bars on it, and the suit that covers him all over, and he's got lead weights all over. You know that kind of guy? And they're always up there. You've seen them in 18 million pictures with Errol Flynn diving down to the wreck. And the sinister villain is pumping the air. And all of a sudden, he does something to the little pump. It stops. And the meter goes back to zero. You know that scene. You've seen that. And down below, you see suddenly the look of terror come into Errol Flynn's eyes. And then there's the big knife fight up top. When his partner comes out of the camera and then finally, you know, you've seen that scene. Well, that's the kind of diver. And they lowered this guy into the dump. You know, he's just pushing the stuff until finally he disappeared in the dump. And there was a picture of him gone in the dump. You couldn't see him. All you could see was the dump now with the hoses coming out of it. Oh, boy. How would you like that for a job? And the diver, when he was hauled out, he said, "Well, I've been doing a lot of deep-sea diving, been diving, you know, for over 30 years. First time, however, I ever dived in a dump. Although it's almost the same when you dive in the East River. However, this was a real dump." He says, I "you get kind of philosophical. You figure, well, you know." I said, "Yeah, I guess you do get kind of philosophical. Well, you know. I mean, you know, you walk along down the bottom of the ocean, you must see a lot of stuff, boy, that the rest of us don't even know exists. You get an idea of the crud of civilization. You'd be surprised what's on the bottom of the East River. Yeah, you walk up knee-deep in that all of your life, and you know something about man. You do, you know? You really do. Like, I'm looking at this. Did you see this old movie on TV? This old Rita Hayworth movie? It was probably the worst job of acting I've ever seen in my life. Rita Hayworth, I mean, she acted like a cigar store Indian with an impacted tooth. It was really bad. Anyway, she was walking around, and they had these little euphemisms. And she says, "What about that island? How about that island there?" She's talking about some island, see? And she's asking the Marine, "What about that island?" He says, "Well, it's the exhaust pipe of the world." That ain't the way I heard it. I'll admit I wasn't in the Marines. They'd have said it different in a Signal Corps, I'll tell you that. But, that, you know, this is a part of it. Anyway, they hauled this guy out. You want to hear the end of the story? They hauled this guy out, see, and he looked around down there, and I guess he saw one fender or something of the giant old earth mover. And so with that, they put him down in there again, and he hooked a thing on it. He hooked a hook on the fender, whatever it is that they have on earth movers. On the big hook that they've got. You know, they always got a big ring or something. So he hooked it on there, and sure enough, they got about 19 bulldozers, and they pulled this bulldozer right out of the glop. And there was a picture of it after it had emerged from the dump, and it looked just like you'd expect it to be. Boy, oh boy, he's going to have a rotten job. I can just see him taking it down to the 32nd magic wash place. Say, "Just run it over, wash it up a little bit." I don't know whether that's a commentary on our civilization or what, but it's a great story, you know? And there it was. It was all over the front page. It says, Man Sues City for $18,000 bulldozer. So they go out and they get the... Well, you know, speaking of knowing you're back home, you just can't... I'm not here at 37... Well, oh, you want to know what I mean by being back home? Well, before we do anything else, let's say this is WORAM at FM New York. And we have a note here. It says, Were you on the beach last weekend? Then be sure to look for your photograph circled every day this week in the Journal American. You could win $200 or other cash prizes for spotting your circle photo in the Journal American Monday through Saturday. That's the oldest gimmick in the newspaper world, you know? You may be the one in the circle. Did I ever tell you about my Uncle Al? My Uncle Al carried to the very last day of his life a clipping that was taken from the Chicago Herald American. And this clipping, they were always running these contests. You know, in fact, at one point, the Chicago Herald American stopped running news. It was getting in the way of the contests. And, you know, they had the contest like a... I remember one contest that my old man was involved in. There was a contest that says, what do you make of these ink blots? It said, in 25 words or less, say what this ink blot means. Every day they had another ink blot. And to the most original interpretations of what the ink blots mean goes the big prize, $20 or whatever it was. And so he was filling those out every night. You know, they had an ink blot. You know, they didn't even know about Rorschachs. They never talked about them. I suppose a lot of people knew. But my old man just thought they were ink blots. So he was writing down cannibals, chasing butterflies and all that kind of stuff. And somewhere, the Chicago Herald American now has a magnificent cross-section of all the ids and the neurosis ills of the entire city of Chicago, or at least that contest-type city. And this is the kind of jazz that... I've already done it, Ted. It's all done. This is the kind of stuff that... the oldest stuff, and it got to the point where the Chicago Herald American really did. It resented news. And as a matter of fact... Yeah, I know. There's a fascinating little bit in one of the newspapers. Have you ever... He didn't hear it. See, he's got to learn to listen, you know. I'll start writing notes. Well, then, you know, the interesting factor that begins to get into this thing is have you ever noticed newspapers advertising about themselves? There's one newspaper in town it doesn't specialize in news. Let's put it this way. It specializes in crash photos on page 3. You know? It also specializes in the picture. You have seen this picture 18 million times. Starlet arrives on Queen Mary. You know that one? And of course they don't do that. It says, Starlet arrives on jet flight from coast. You know, she's sitting up there. And somehow, I don't know what these chicks are always sitting on when they're arriving on a jet plane from the coast. I never get sat up on a box way up in the air when I arrive on a jet plane from the coast. You ever, Ed? Well, either do they. You see, if they had pretty legs, it'd be an excuse for it, but most of their legs are like a group of armor star hams hanging from a string, you know? I don't mind that, except that they keep saying, Curvaceous young Lesbia O'Toole arrives on jet flight 707 from Los Angeles, where she is currently at work on her picture, Whoopi. And you see her there, you know. Whoever this chick is, you never hear about her again, you know. She's just staring out at us. And that's the kind of photographs and already, I can assure you right now, set in galley proof already, set already in lead, there are at least 25 photographs of a little kid standing by a fire hydrant here in New York City, and there is a cop who is looking down at the kid, and it says, Too bad, kid, we can't turn it on today, or something like that, and handing the kid an ice cream cone. You want to bet? Either that, or there is a picture of a whole bunch of kids running through a fire hydrant, and it says, Fun on the Street. It says, yes, the fire department yesterday afternoon closed off the 400 block on 82nd Street, and here are the kids disporting themselves in the hottest day of the year. Sizzle. They always have something like sizzle. You know, that picture's already being prepared. Then there is another picture being prepared. It shows Tiny Tot Loses Drawers. And it shows a little kid who has lost the bottom half of his play suit, you see. And you see a big cop standing next to him, and the cop has him by the hand. It says, Tiny Tot Loses Bottom Half of Play Suit at Coney Island. Officer O'Leary shown taking Tiny Tot lost to... to the lost and found house at Coney Island. The tiny tot was later claimed by his mother, Lesbia O'Toole. And it shows, you know, that picture is right now in galley print. And, you know, there's a whole series of pictures like that and news stories that, of course, that is also coupled with the news story. Man celebrates 109th birthday, gives advice. I say cigars, wild whiskey, and women. All the way down the line. That one is in there. It says J.D. Flintrock of Bangor, Maine, 109. Then there's the other one that says, well, I think good thoughts, and I never got married, and actually I haven't had a cigar or any kind of alcohol in my whole life. Abstinence will do it every time. So, you know, they have the self-canceling ones so that they don't offend anybody in their audience. The drunks or the anti-drunks, you know. The paper doesn't want to go on record as being for anything, actually, you know, except blow 'em up, which is roughly but very close to the foreign policy of these newspapers. Ah, for crying out loud, kill 'em. Either that, you know. Or, the city hall, bunch of crooks. There's that editorial policy, too. That's another one. Or here's another one, too, is, them eggheads in Washington. Wise guys, eggheads. That's another one of the editorial policies of these newspapers. Well, it begins to lap over into their ads. One of these newspapers, which is a notorious slob newspaper, has a series of ads saying, are you really sophisticated? Oh, the real sophisticate is the one who not only knows something about the megaton bombs, but also knows that Casey Stengel's an important guy. Who not only knows something about the theater, like Zsa Zsa Gabor and other famous people in theater, but also knows that a lot of fun can be had at the beach. You know, all that kind of stuff. Oh, boy. and it goes all the way on down and until, you know, it's rampant anti-intellectualism. And not only rampant, but it's the kind of aggressive kind. And then there's the big ad that says, news with a sock on every page. And it shows this naked leg sticking out. That's the news policy, see? Either that or they... So the other day when I read this statistic released by this world organization said... It was one of the big organizations over at the UN. That 70% of the people all over the world that they were able to investigate, in a three-year poll, by the way, know absolutely nothing about what's going on in the world. They are totally in the dark. It was one of the greatest headlines I've ever read, Al. It said 70% of the world in the dark. Well, the only thing you can conclude is that 70% of the world wants to be in the dark. Because it's very angry about what's out there in the light. You know, so it prefers to be in the dark. You know, it's not gonna look out there and see what the realities of the world are about, really. It bugs people to know what's really happening, generally. Almost any kind of truth bugs people. I mean, the truth that you're getting older bugs you. All right, you are, so you're getting older. All right, so you don't like it. But that doesn't affect it. You are, you know. Whether you like it or not. And there's almost any kind of truth tease people off. Really, in the worst possible kind of way. And so naturally, 70% of the people give in to that. And they prefer just to pull the shades down. You know, how many people... Well, I've known at least... I'd say at least 10 people in my life who, the instant they get into their house, pull the shades down and get under the covers in one way or another, you know. Either they turn the record player up to 18 dB above S9 and plunge themselves into some kind of fantasy of one kind or another, but they try to lock out everything that's out there. They lock it out, you know. They pull everything down. It's a kind of hibernation. And you know, that takes many forms. I just wonder what's going through the mind of a person who spends almost every available night watching musicals. What kind of an escape is this, you know? Well, he's locking out something. When he's questioned about it, he says, well, I go to the theater to see... I don't go to the theater for ideas. I go to the theater for entertainment. Good, clean fun. Well, you ask him why he reads the slob newspaper. Let me tell you what I read the newspaper for. I want to get the ball game scores. When I want a sermon, I won't go to a newspaper. Well, then in the end, you find out, you ask him what church he goes, see, and you find out that he's going to one of these wild churches where they roughly parallel making dough with godliness or whatever, you know. And he says to you, well, let me tell you this. Let me tell you, no guy's going to get up on the front there in the pulpit and tell me who's a good man and who ain't a good man. Let me tell you that. Who's to say who's good? I go to a church by George where they got their feet on the ground. Let me tell you this. And so in the end, you ask him where he does go for ideas, and you find out he doesn't go any place for ideas. Theater, don't bother him with that. Books, don't bother him with that. It can all be summed up in Billy Rose's fantastically slobbish remark that is constantly being quoted by the David Merrick types, saying, I'm going to leave the messages to Western Union. Any messages, that's for Western Union. And, of course, the guy's in an art form. Quote, the only place where a message literally is almost mandatory. I mean, you know, if you're going to art, I mean, what? So on the other hand, by the way, speaking of getting back here, the reason I feel this sense of getting back, I was away on the weekend, and really away. I mean, really away. I was in the heartland of America, truly, over the weekend. Genuinely the heartland of America. When you say the heartland, well, let's say almost the center of America. I was in St. Louis. This is pretty close to the heartland, you know. On the Mississippi River, which, in a sense, is the heartland of America, if you know anything about the river and about the value of the Mississippi, what it is, the peculiar quality of them. You know, the rivers you got out here in the East are very different rivers from the genuinely great rivers of the world. I have seen several of the great rivers of the world, what they call great rivers. The Nile, which is a great river. Certainly you cannot argue the fact that the Rhine is one of the great rivers of the world. I've seen the Rhine many times. And I've seen, of course, the Missouri, which is another one. And you cannot, well, the greatest of them all, really. Of course, there are many ways to measure a river. There's the, how long is it? Well, that is not necessarily a measure of the greatness of a river. Some rivers are gigantic. They're wide. They're almost like lakes, long, skinny lakes. Other rivers are rivers who achieve their greatness, or that achieve their greatness, because of the vastness of the terrain that they drain, and also the amount of, dependence that terrain has upon them. And this is where the Mississippi is one of the greatest of all rivers. There's a magnificent description of the Mississippi, by the way, just a technical description of the Mississippi and its greatness in the foreword, just the opening remarks in Mark Twain's book, Life on the Mississippi. If you've never read that book, you're missing a true experience in Americana. You know, this is back in the days when writers were much more concerned with the world around them. And I'm not talking about in the nature sense. I'm talking about in the world around them and its relationship to man than today, where the average writer is much more concerned with the quality of lint in his navel. It's a very different kind of writing. And the atmosphere that most of the people live in the Salinger world, for example, is the atmosphere of air conditioners rattling in the window. Once in a while, the sound of a cab can be heard outside. And when they move from one place to the other, it is in a cab, you know. And this is a very different world, you see. So man, in the end, gets very much of a hothouse quality about himself. He becomes a hothouse flower, literally. And like hothouse flowers, pale and sickly and wan, like a hothouse tomato. You know the difference between a hothouse tomato and a real tomato growing in Indiana? Have you ever had a real tomato, a real one? Like a real, a genuine midsummer tomato from the Jersey tomato fields. You know, you grab one of these things, and it almost reaches out and grabs you. It's almost got claws when you got hold of it. It's really alive, you know? It really is. You can feel it, and it pulses. It's got a beat to it, you know? And it lays there in your hands, boy, and you think the thing is going to hatch right there. No, it's the truth, you know. And you get these little pale tomatoes, you know, that come out of Florida. You know these little things that come in the plastic things, you know, with the little plastic with the cellophane cover, and it says 89 cents on it. These little pale tomatoes that look like these little phony ones that they used to have made out of wax. They're really made out of a new kind of pliofilm, these tomatoes, tomato flavored, you know, low calorie and everything. And no pizzazz at all. And these are kind of like Schraff's tomatoes. I don't know, you know, the Schraff ladies. It's a kind of, I don't know what it is, you know. You can't even get drunk on the brandy they serve in Schraff's. I don't know. There's something they do with it. But nevertheless, these tomatoes are typical. They're very much the same as the people, hothouse people. You know, they're pale and wan and very nervous. These tomatoes are nervous. And I can tell you, a real fat, angry Indiana tomato that's been laying in the sun, and they, boy, they lay in the sun. You can hear them moaning out there in the dark some nights. Out there just sweating. A tomato will lay out there on the riverbank and just sweat for weeks. Out there in the dark, you can hear it. You know, once in a while, you hear one blow its nose. And, no, really. It's funny. When you go out to pick a tomato, you grab that tomato and it fights, literally. A real tomato just fights. Hangs on there, clings to the vine. You pull up, and it comes off. You know? It's a very different kind of tomato, you know? Really, I don't suppose you know about that living here in New York, since most of us are attuned to the hothouse world. And getting out to the heartland, suddenly I was back there again, you know. I mean, really back there. You know, I want to tell you about something right now. Another thing that contributes, and this is a preface to that, the hothouse aspect of a tomato that is growing under hothouse conditions, where they come around with a little dropper of something and sprinkle it on the little rooties there. They don't have roots, you know. And little thingies there. You just can't imagine a tomato, a hothouse tomato being rotten. You know? Let me tell you, boy, when a rotten tomato is rotten in Indiana, it is rotten. It's out there, you know, laying in the mud. Just like a hothouse guy, when he goes bad, doesn't really go bad. He starts to weep in the corner, you know. You know that kind of it. Let me tell you, when a guy in Indiana goes bad, he goes bad. I mean, I'll never forget old man Bruner. Old man Bruner, you know what old man Bruner did? He ran up and down the basement stairs trying to get up there. The trouble is he'd gotten tangled with all kinds of stuff down in the basement. See, they made cider. And Bruner was down there trying the cider for over 3 days once. And so he tries to get up the basement stairs. Bruner spent 4 days going up the basement stairs. He just keep falling up and falling down. Can you imagine Franny or Zooey doing this in Salinger? Not a bit of it. Bruner'd hit his head on the concrete block and just start right up again. He just figured Mrs. Bruner was hitting him. Well, all right, now the point that I'm making here is that badness is even a measure of how much the artificiality has crept into us. So in the end, you wind up with a peculiar feeling. The hothouse aspect of New York life takes many forms. One of the forms it takes immediately is when there's 3 drops of rain outside, everybody runs. Just like a hothouse tomato, when the temperature goes up or down, oh, they don't? Where have you been living, Al? What are you talking about? No. Why, everybody in this town has been talking about the heat. You know what the temperature is? 82. Greasy kid stuff. 82 degrees. For crying out loud, let me tell you, 82 degrees, 82 degrees is a cold day in Missouri in the summer. It is. Do you know anything about the infield out at Busch Stadium? Boy, I'm telling you, when they swat ground balls down there, it's like playing ball on concrete. Ka-chung, 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 and they go bouncing past in the outfield. The grass is burnt purple out there. These guys, I mean, this is real. Oh, yeah, it was famous playing. The St. Louis Browns, for crying out loud, played their whole season wearing tennis shoes. They did one season because their spikes just didn't go in the ground. They're running around. You don't wear spikes out here playing on the concrete road any more than you wear spikes on the infield. Really, they did wear those shoes. That's the kind of heat they have out. And nobody talks about it, is what I'm trying to tell you. Because it is part of the world you live in. See, we control our world so much here in New York that we think nature's getting out of control when it's 82. It's ridiculous. What's it doing to me? Because, you know, everybody, he just adjusts all the little knobs on the side of the wall, you know, and it blows everything at him, you know. Around here, we got air conditioners that give memos out. Right here, WOR. That's the truth, you know. Everybody is living in this hothouse air-conditioned world with the windows sealed. No wonder our news is so, you know, sometimes. You wonder where it comes from. It doesn't come from the world, you know. It comes out of this little filter unit they have there, you see. It's funny. I'll tell you, I'll never forget one night listening to a newscast, and I knew that 18 different things had happened. The guy went on. This was on our own station here. He went on for 7 minutes about a tie-up on the A train that had happened 3 hours earlier and was now over. I mean, who worries about yesterday afternoon's tie-up on the A train? funny. And New York prides itself on being a very sophisticated, very, very angry city that really keeps abreast of things, you know. Come on, get it out of your skull. I'm telling you, my grandmother used to have a word, spitzen. She used to have a word that refers to the sky, spitzen. When the sky is unter spitzen, meaning when a little rain comes down, immediately there's 85 signs go up in every block says umbrellas and overshoes for sale here. Getting back to the story here, you get attuned to this kind of thing. You get attuned to this cab world, this world where people only feel secure when they can hear the sound of an air conditioning unit within comfortable reasoning sound, you know, somewhere within a block or two, so they can hear it. You walk up and down on the east side, I'd say at this hour of the morning, 2 o'clock, you go up there 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can hear a hum in the air. I mean, you're right out in the middle of the street, you hear this hum, this air conditioning hum all over. You walk along, and you can feel a little rain coming down when these little things are spitting. That's as close to the rain, actually, as many people get when their air conditioning unit drips out of the bottom of the pan there. So, anyway, let me tell you what happened. You talk about storms? Let me tell you, Dad. I'm on the Mississippi River Saturday morning, and we're on a towboat. And you know what is it, a towboat? Well, I'll tell you what a towboat is. A towboat is what has taken over since the old days of the paddle. You know, they don't have paddle wheelers on the Mississippi anymore. Movies and all this to the contrary. There is only one, as far as they know, that is regularly, but it's only working as a kind of a little cruise thing, you know, a little funny thing. And that's the Island Queen. Did I ever tell you about the time I used to ride on the Island Queen? The Delta Queen, I guess, is still going. I used to ride on the Island Queen out of Cincinnati. And the Island Queen used to go down to New Orleans, go past Louisville, and down the Great Ohio until she joined the Mississippi, and then straight on down to the Gulf. One of the most beautiful sights in the world, believe me, is the sight of a sternwheeler coming along in the dusk with all her top lights going and the sound of her band or her calliope playing and moving right down the middle of that pitch black river. It's a beautiful sight. There's just no sight like it. I don't know how to describe it except to say if you've never seen one, you have missed one of the major sights of America. It's a beautiful sight. Well, they don't have them anymore, so you won't see them. But nevertheless, and by the way, this is not a nostalgic piece. I'll tell you, when I traveled on the Island Queen, the Island Queen was still operating in 1952 and 53, as recent as that, and the Island Queen finally blew up at the dock in Pittsburgh. She came in, do you remember that, Ed? Blew up, and that was it, her boilers gave. But I want to tell you about storms. Saturday morning, I'm out on the Mississippi, and a towboat, really is not a towboat, it's a push boat. Generally, the towboats push their barges, and they have these gigantic barges that hold, 40 and 50,000 pounds of stuff, tremendous barges, and a total barge run, maybe as many as 30 barges all strung out in double lines. Tremendous long thing. In fact, these barges, the barge trains, are longer than the longest ocean liner. They were just extending out there for hundreds and hundreds of feet. And way at the end of that is this captain in this beautiful, just absolutely spotless, magnificently designed boat that has staterooms in it that you'd never believe aboard a boat like that, and wonderful food, people with white coats serving it, you know. You never believe it. They have preserved that part of the Mississippi, that kind of life. I don't know what it is. There's a certain flair to it, where there's a certain tradition to it. And the captain is high up above this thing, and he's steering this enormous... You think you have trouble parking? You ought to try to steer one of these things that's longer than the Queen Mary through the docks, through the locks, rather, going downstream. You know what the locks are, really, don't you? Well, the locks are systems of locks, literally, that lower the boats as they come from all the way up in Minnesota someplace sometimes, and they just keep lowering the level of the water. It's like being helped down. It's like a giant escalator. And they'll lower it 6 or 7 feet, and then they'll drop them down to the next level until finally, just south of St. Louis, they hit the Great Mississippi itself. That is the final run that goes all the way down to New Orleans, and there are no more locks. They just stay out and they go. But these captains are magnificent people, really strange people. And they're almost the same as they were when Mark Twain discussed them. They have to know every inch of the river, and they are licensed by the number of miles they know. In other words, if a man knows the river from Keokuk, or let's say he knows the river from, we'll just take a town, let's say Keokuk, or say St. Louis, to, well, Keokuk is even better because it's outside of the locks. Let's take Duluth. There's a real big timer. If he knows the river from, say, Duluth all the way to New Orleans, he is licensed to operate on that part of the river, and he's given periodic examinations. Now, it's a masterpiece of memory that a captain can look out of the window of his boat, just and this is 2,000 miles of river, by the way. He can look out of the river. You blindfold him. You drop him down any place on the river, and you say, "Where are you, Charlie?" And he looks out. And he'll say, "We're three-quarters of a mile south of Portsmouth. And bar number 422 is coming up on the left right now. You better move out. Easy, easy. Right rudder." And he starts going, you know. They have immediately. Did you know that, Ed? Immediately. They don't steer by sight. They steer by memory. And these guys are constantly giving each other information. So one guy goes downstream, and he keeps a notebook of things that have changed. If a bar changes a little, you know, the bars are continually changing on the river because of the current of the river. The river never is the same, ever. And so he makes a note, and then he meets one of his buddies downstream, and he gives him all the information of what he's going to meet going upstream, you know. So it's a really interesting in-group, and boy, they have their own world. You think that the world of the theater is an in-world. Can you imagine what a small, tight, and special world the world of a Mississippi River pilot is? Nobody else knows what he knows, you know, really. You just don't know what he knows. And he sort of looks out with a kind of vague smile, and you can't, you know, he can't communicate with you. Just kind of looks out there. You ask him these silly questions like, "What's that thing over there?" And he says, "That's a wreck." And you say, "A wreck?" You just see a little ripple in water. Yeah, he knows exactly where it is, you see. Even in the dark, he knows where it is. He can tell by lights and different little things in the air. Well, anyway, I'm on this towboat, say, and I'll tell you what happened Saturday. We're out there, and it's about, I'd say it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon now, and the sun has been beating down mercilessly. And when I say sun, I mean, I don't know what you people in New York would do. You would go out of your skull if you had sun like this. I would say roughly the temperature on the boat got down below 100 degrees, I'd say maybe twice during the day. I would say she ranged around 99 and 101 out on the deck all day long. And don't say, "Well, they don't feel it as much out there because, you know, it's the humidity." Well, I'd say roughly, do you know what the humidity is in the river area? In a lower, oh, you don't know what humidity is. Oh, boy. And these people never mention it, you know. It's all part of nature. So, anyway, we're on this boat. And about, it must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one of the most magnificent sights I've seen in a long time. It suddenly reminded me of the world out there. I would say that this would be a good thing for almost every New Yorker to do once in a while, to get out and see there's another world out there. And I'm not talking about a slob world or anything like that, or the great world of the enormous highway, that there really is something happening. And I'm out there on the bridge of this boat, and I go back to the fantail, and we were doing something there, when suddenly, over all around the whole horizon, is the thing that I once described on the show, and I had almost forgotten really how it was. You could see these great, jagged, black pieces of cloud that were beginning to roll towards us. And I mean, out there, the sky is immense. I mean, you really see sky. And you could see these little flickers of lightning. It's coming. And you could feel heavy drops of water coming down, just beginning to scud across the water. And you could see the river itself. Have you ever watched the river when a blow is coming up, Ed? You get these little choppy kind of waves, just little choppy waves going every direction. And then this great black curtain. It's a huge curtain is beginning to go closer and closer to the horizon, and the horizon invariably in the time, what are you doing in there? The horizon invariably gets to be bright, almost like milk. It gets so bright, it's just shining. And deeper comes this black curtain until finally it touches the horizon, and the minute that it touches the horizon, you get this cold puff of wind. And up to that point, the air has been almost motionless. And the lightning begins to play above you, and it's lightning you never see because it's buried in the clouds. It's buried in this blackness. And this enormous storm hits us. But it comes rolling up the river like a great big steamroller. It just comes rolling right up the river. And I'm caught up on the deck there, and whoom, that wind goes across. And these enormous, the drops of water were half the size of ping pong balls, just cutting across that deck. And the water is moving past the bow, just whipped to a tremendous froth. And by the way, Mississippi River water is roughly the color of... you cut me there. It's roughly the color of, half and half coffee and cream. It's a rich, creamy caramel color everywhere. And that is not to say that it's dirty water. As a matter of fact, the old rivermen in the Mark Twain's day, maintained that that's the only kind of water to drink because it really irrigates your insides. The silt that moves down through your upper intestines is good, you know, moves it right down through there. And they used to drink, carry bottles of it like you carry bottles of coffee with to drink. But there's this water, froth, and it's sort of a creamy froth, like a caramel sundae. And the little boat is just, without so much as moving, just moving right up through that storm. You don't feel anything except the rattle of the windows. And the captain is standing up on the bridge. I go up there, and he's got these tremendous windows that are just as clean. You can't imagine how clean these windows are. It's like there's no windows at all. But that storm is hitting it. Bang! It's crashing, and the water is moving down. He's not even moving a hair, just operating this thing and working the wheel a little bit. You hear the steam of the telegraph. And this was a real storm. I mean, a real storm. And I could see standing up on the horizon. You can really see the horizon out there, you know. Standing up on the horizon when the lightning would flicker, you could see these long high-tension wires. You know, we never see high-tension wires here, really, in the East. Oh, you see them out along the turnpike. It's a very different thing. I'm just saying there's a different life out there. I'm not putting the East down now. All these people start, oh, now what do you mean? I'm just telling you the life is different. Don't try to tell me you live like they live in the Mojave Desert. You don't. And you, this is...